How can we determine when other faith communities, or even secular communities, maintain truths that we should support? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm your host, Alden Thompson, and we continue our series on Proverbs. And our focus this week is on chapters 22 to 24. My conversation partners are Dave Thomas, Dean of the Walla Walla University School of Theology, and Linda Emerson, an assistant professor of philosophy. Now, I'm tempted to dump this one in Linda's land because she's our philosopher and explores a lot of other thinkers. How can we determine when those guys are telling us the truth?
I don't know who you mean by those guys, because we're it's all us guys.
Okay.
I'm
outside of our community, you know, because if you take a rigorously
parochial view of yourself.
Very parochial view of yourself, and that is the nature of a sectarian community. You are counterculture. You're against everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's difficult to imagine that there could be any good out there. I remember even when I was a kid, little kid, and the kid across the street who happened to, I think, attend the Methodist church, but he told me his favorite Christian song was Onward Christian Soldiers, and I got a bit angry.
Hey, it's my song.
Yeah, that's my song. That's not yours.
See, that's one of the advantages of coming to Adventism after being part of two other Protestant communities.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, they sing those hymns too?
Yeah.
We've talked about this a little bit already.
In previous weeks,
in creating that Venn diagram where we actually see intersections of thought. So I guess one of the things I think we all need to do is take upon ourselves the responsibility to become aware of where there are intersections between what we perceive as true, I'm going to use a little t, true from our perspective, and what people outside of this, if you will, this very small community might perceive are true. And those areas of intersection, I think we see these areas of intersection, and some of them are actually quite big. We also then see areas of clear difference. I think two things have to happen there. One, at that time, I think we have to say, okay, this is different from what I have been taught is true. Now I need to understand how it is that someone might think that X is true as opposed to the Y that I have been taught is true. But there is another opportunity for us. And I think this is the one that's a little more frightening for those of us inside a sectarian bubble, if you will. And that is to say, now I need to look at what I have presumed to be true and be willing to hold what I have presumed to be true up to the same standard of scrutiny as the other person's idea about what is true.
You know, C.S. Lewis has an interesting comment there. Now, he's talking about changing from theism to atheism.
Right.
But he says his rule of thumb is you ought to always continue to believe what you've always believed to be true until good, solid reasons are given for believing otherwise. In other words, you start where you are.
Yeah.
And then he says, and those good, solid reasons, he says, often are not there. You send a kid to Oxford, he says, and he loses his faith first year, says, what are the chances that he's been argued out of it? No. And he talks about his own experience. He says, I find God less believable in a hotel room than when I'm home on campus. The society of unbelievers makes faith harder, even when there are people whose opinions on any other subject are known to be worthless. That's C.S. Lewis.
Sure. But I don't think that means that we don't have some moral obligation to consider. And maybe he addresses that in the context of overwhelming evidence for reconsidering our ideas. But I think that's where the issue of uncertainty really comes into play in a robust way that's not comfortable for us. Even what we hold to be true, we have to recognize can only ever be partial truth because we live here. in a finite world, and we can never be in that infinite world. Uncertainty is part of our existence here.
Yeah.
And I don't say that to, and I realize that's a really hard thing, especially for a conservative person to hear, and maybe this characterizes me as someone who is something less than conservative on this issue, but I just think it's a fact of our existence.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that we don't embrace as true these ideas, but we embrace as true these ideas with a real healthy humility.
See, the fact that we are always learning, Linda,
yeah.
is very significant.
Yes,
because if I am always learning, it means I don't yet know everything.
That's right.
And so the idea of absolute certainty, as long as I am learning, I cannot have absolute certainty.
Correct.
See, until I have achieved all learning, then I can start talking about it.
And how can you and I ever have all that?
Well, you can't
but
do that.
But you can have certain anchors that stay firm.
Of course.
Yeah, and you know, another thing that, and I've learned this from my students too, in these conversations about faith and learning, that sometimes what is called for is not a flippant letting go. I think that's something that happens to us when we're younger and maybe more impressionable, maybe even not having a strong sense of who we are,
mm-hmm.
And how it is that we have come to think that the ideas we embrace as true are true. But to learn to live more deeply within the traditions that we hold to be true. So we're not just thinking about, for instance, the issue of outward adornment as one that's talking about earrings and necklaces, but now we're talking about what it means in a much deeper sense, all material ways that we adorn ourselves, all intellectual ways that we adorn ourselves. You see, you know, even our infatuation with what we, quote, know becomes a kind of
earrings.
Adornment.
You can't wear earrings, but you could show up in a $90,000 automobile.
Well, there you go, and we don't have a problem with that. Or you can profess to know things that you don't really know, which is another kind of adornment, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Anyway, so I guess just live more deeply.
Sure. Alden,
I would add one little piece to this, is that if you are a creationist and you believe that there is a great commonality in all human beings, at least in terms of origin, you have to conclude also then that there must be a certain commonality to human structures of thought.
That's an interesting idea.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Now, let me build the bridge to Proverbs, okay? Because in this week's section, Proverbs 22-24, there is a fascinating piece of wisdom literature, to use a technical term, called The Wisdom of Amenemopa. Okay?
Mm.
It's a collection of 30 statements, 30 sayings, but a number of them are virtually identical parallels with this piece that's been discovered in Egypt. Now, if you go back earlier, the Adventist Bible Commentary, for example, mid-century, would argue that the wisdom literature of Egypt must surely have borrowed the stuff from the Bible. Now, there is evidence, pretty solid evidence, that the wisdom of Amenemopa was around 1300, which is 300 years before Solomon. So almost nobody argues that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And you now have points, common points, and what I've done is simply taken a list here in three areas where you have common ground between the wisdom of Amenemopa, not Jewish, you know, certainly not maybe even theistic in the same sense, although you don't have atheists in the ancient cultures. But let me just read these, and then we'll talk about it some more. First of all, here's one section on helping the poor. Now, I'm quoting here from Proverbs, but these are then the close parallels with Wisdom of Amenemopa. 22:22, do not exploit the poor because they are poor. And do not crush the needy in court, for the Lord will take up their case and will exact life for life. Pretty good stuff.
Pretty good stuff.
Now, dealings with the ill-bred, the angry, and the fools. 22:24, do not make friends with a hot-tempered person. Do not associate with one easily angered. 25, or you may learn their ways and get yourself ensnared. Almost sounds like a good Christian family who says to their kids, now be careful who you play with. 23:9, do not speak to fools, for they will scorn your prudent words. Now, the other one, we've touched on this before, and so we won't need to go into it, but this has to do with going into being security for someone. Do not be one who shakes hands in pledge or puts up security for debts. If you lack the means to pay, your very bed will be snatched from under you.
Well, that is true. When debt collectors come, they bend all effort.
They take it all. Mm-hmm. So that's the background that, you know, it's been difficult for those in a sectarian community, and that would certainly be the Seventh-day Adventist community, to recognize the value of other ones. Now, I've done quite a bit of study, and our charismatic leader, Ellen White, she has a remarkable statement about, well, she says, when you go to work in other areas, you don't need to tell them all the distinctives where we are so different from them. Work with them on points on which you can agree.
Mm-hmm.
Show them that you love Jesus, and there will be time enough for doctrine. In other words, you have to do enough studying, thinking to find out on what points you can agree.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, that goes back to my point earlier of learning about other systems of thought. I mean, how is it that people have come to think those ways?
Yep.
Right.
And at our house, we've just finishing William James, Varieties of Religious Experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the first time I've read it. We read it together, Wanda and I.
Oh, that's great.
But what he does is take the extremes.
Yes.
And then plots the middle ground in between.
Yeah.
And it's just really absolutely fascinating to see how he does that.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't need to be scared because there might be other people out there who hold the same thing we do.
Yeah, I think that is a really important emotional point. I think we are sometimes I think as Adventists we are fearful.
Yep.
And I guess in the small f sense of, you know, in we're afraid of others.
Yep.
We're afraid that we will become. We've taken this admonition so seriously of becoming like the fools that we just want to make sure we don't we protect ourselves, and we're preparing for the time of trouble when, you know, all these people are going to be after us in one way or another. And I feel sad about that.
You know what made a huge difference for me?
No.
Ellen White's interpretation of the parable of the sheep and the goats. Because when we first went to Scotland, I mean, I'm a fourth generation Adventist. You know, I've been in this kind of isolated setting. We were basically, I'll admit it, I was afraid to have too much contact with those people. And when we left first time, we said, we can do better than that. And it was then I discovered Ellen White's statement where she says, those whom Christ commends in the judgment may have known little of theology, but they have cherished his principles. She says, among the heathen are those who have. And so she makes room in the kingdom for the good heathen. And that's radically different from most evangelicals. We had friends who were neighbors, who were Christian Science, Plymouth Brethren.
Mm-hmm.
All of those people were just wonderful friends because I was able to make that adjustment in our mind. So I think it's possible to discover good links with other people and do it well.
Yeah, there's a great commonality to truth, I think, in human experience.
Yep. Right.
All right, I want to thank you, too, for helping again, David and Linda. And I want to thank Dave Olson, program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.